Dear guests, good afternoon. This is Volkan Yılmaz. I'm currently the head of Social Policy Forum at Boğaziçi. On behalf of the forum, I would like to welcome you all to the Social Policy Seminar Series on Health Inequalities. And these seminars are co-organized by the forum and the Raoul Wallenberg Institute of Human Rights. I'd like to start by thanking to my colleagues at Raoul Wallenberg, our research assistants Anil Gencer, Nazlı Avşaroğlu, and the coordinator of our forum, Begüm, for all their efforts that made this happen. We are living in a post-truth world, post-truth society, so it has become, I think, increasingly complicated to talk about the common problems of our humanity. And the larger the social inequalities are in our societies, people have been left with less power to talk about it, to denounce them. And interestingly, the academia in general gets less interested in these kind of topics. Professor Dorling, with his immense body of scholarly work, has offered one of the most persistent critiques of social inequalities and their negative impacts on societies. So it is with this special excitement that I am pleased to welcome Professor Danny Dorling to our university. He is currently Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. His latest book, The Equality Effect, Improving Life for Everyone, was published last year. Here, Danny is going to talk about health inequalities in the UK, across Europe, and in affluent societies. I would like to extend my sincere gratitude to Danny for being with us today. So, dear guests, please join me in welcoming Professor Danny Dorling.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you for having me. Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here. It is actually my first time in Turkey ever. So, if I say things which are silly or stupid, please let me off slightly. You're right about the changing interest of academia. I first of all studied these things in the 1980s when we were really angry about what was going on, and we produced paper after paper, particularly in social medicine and epidemiology, about the widening gap in health between the poor and the rich. And it was a great... I hope we get some children coming in. If you give a talk like this in Norway or Finland, there would normally be at least two babies in the audience. If you give a talk in countries which are different, I correlate as you're going to find out everything to income inequality, maybe too much, but the number of babies in the audience decreases the more unequal the country is. So you know your country is doing well when there are babies in the audience. Hopefully the children will come back. Where was I? Yes, 1980s. We were very angry about the inequalities that were beginning to rise, particularly in the United States and where I'm from, the United Kingdom. And then we were a little bit less angry in the 1990s. And then in the 2000s, social medicine in particular and epidemiology discovered genes and genome, and they got very excited about genes and they stopped worrying about inequalities. The interesting thing now is that as inequalities in some countries have got wider and wider, that attention for the 1980s is having to be focused again on the problem. But because it went out of academic fashion, it now requires younger scholars to look at these things. I'm going to show you quite a lot of graphs and tell you quite a lot of anecdotes. But I thought I'd just start with this reference in case anybody wonders what's the evidence for all of this. There's lots and lots of evidence for what I'm going to say. This is a paper produced just 2 weeks ago by Max Barnish, Amicia Torres, and Becky Nelson-Holm, which is a systematic review of, I think it's, could be 180 studies, I've forgotten the number. The conclusion, and maybe I'm preaching to the converted here in this university, but the conclusion at the bottom is that welfare state generosity, left of centre democratic political tradition, and democracy are generally positively associated with population health. This is becoming so overwhelmingly obvious now that that is part of the reason that people don't study this. It's a little bit like in the 1980s, it's like the 1940s looking at cancer, lung cancer and cigarette smoking. And in the 1940s, you couldn't be sure whether smoking cigarettes caused lung cancer. It was exciting and you did papers on it. And in the 1950s, you did more papers, particularly research that looked at doctors who smoke, just doctors. And you find that the doctors who smoke die of lung cancer faster than doctors who don't smoke. The tobacco industry tries to stop you saying that tobacco is bad. Now everybody accepts that cigarettes cause cancer. It's not an exciting thing, and so people don't research it. And in a way, the early work in the 80s and the 90s saying that economic inequality was bad for health was contentious. It wasn't necessarily, you couldn't be sure that you were right, that this was the agent. People might argue that it's lack of trust in society, societies where people don't trust each other, have bad health. Or they would argue, oh, it's ethnic homogeneity. It's where you've got races which don't get on with each other in a society where it goes bad. It's not inequality. That's the reason. But now it's just almost too obvious. In the 1980s we were saying the United Kingdom and the United States, after the rich countries were doing badly, and they're doing badly because of inequality, and the Scandinavian countries were doing well because they were more equal. In the last 10 years, we've watched life expectancy fall in the United States and United Kingdom. We've watched infant mortality rise. And in the Scandinavian countries, we've watched things getting better and better. A baby is half as likely to die in Finland as in the UK now. So I will try not to sound jaded or angry, but it's partly because I think it is so simple. That how you organise a society, including how much money you give some people and how much money you give others, affects everything else. It affects everything from your transport systems, whether they're well organised, to your housing system, to what kind of jobs people do, whether they enjoy the jobs they do or they don't enjoy the jobs they do. It affects whether your education system is efficient and effective or not, and it affects above all health, which is the most important thing. Here's the abstract. So I'd like to try and get the abstract of the talk before I go further to remind myself. I want to try and keep to what I said I'm going to do. Here's the questions I want to try to begin to answer for you. Why in the United States, in particular states within the United States, are babies several times more likely today to die than in some of the best off countries of the world? Why are we still talking about infant mortality? I should say, I'm going to concentrate on things that are bad. There's an enormous amount that is good in the world, and there's an enormous amount that is good in Europe. Worldwide, a few years ago, infant mortality was 42 babies dying per 1,000 born, and was dropping about 5, even 6% a year. So it dropped from 42 to 40 to 38 to 36. That is the fastest it can ever fall in the history of human beings, because it can't get to zero. It can probably get to one per thousand. So worldwide, we're living through the best of times ever as a species. The number of parents in the world who are grieving over a dead baby today is half what it was a generation ago. And there are far more babies born now than a generation ago. So there is lots and lots of good news. There is lots of good news in Europe. There are lots of things getting better. People tend to tell a story of things getting worse. They talk about the rise of the far right across Europe. Nobody talks about the fall of the far right, sometimes in the majority of European countries, quietly. But it's almost the job of social science to concentrate on the things that are worse, because if you don't concentrate on them, they don't get better. In the same way that in medicine, people concentrate on the illnesses, they don't concentrate on people being well. So first of all, the babies, and we'll do some of that next. But then why is life expectancy? Life expectancy, which is a product of many, many things over a long time, why does that correlate so well with inequality, and where are the differences? Why in particular are elderly people in Norway and Finland and Japan, where they've already got up to ages that we've never seen people live to before. Why in those countries where the elderly are doing so well, are they doing even better? You wouldn't expect the countries where they've become the oldest. And why in countries where life expectancy is already lower? I concentrate on the most affluent countries in the world because I'm interested in what happens when you've got enough. Why in the countries where life expectancy is actually lower, is it falling? That's the kind of question you need to address. Evidence and some suggestions, and then you can quiz me. The first of quite a few graphs. I do apologise for so many graphs. I don't know how many graphs you get in your courses and so on, but we're going to just warn you they're coming. They tend to always be in this form. Most of them are in this form. Along the bottom, we've got a measure of inequality. We used to worry a lot about what measure of inequality you did, whether you used the Gini coefficient, or in this case, this is how much the best off 10th have compared to the worst off 10th. So in Singapore, the best off 10th of the population had about 18 times more than the worst off 10th of the population. In Japan, it was about 7. So it's a measure of inequality along the bottom. Along the y-axis, you've got just infant mortality, the proportion of babies who are born who die that year, out of 1,000. The rates are low, but there you can see that the United States as a whole is sitting at 7. And if you go down to Japan, and you can't see the names of those smaller countries, but they are Norway, Finland, and so on. You're down at about 3, heading down towards 2 now. This slide is a few years old. The circles are size by population. So we don't take Scandinavia too seriously. Scandinavia is lovely, but it's very, very small. Norway has oil, for no reasons. Japan is the interesting, more important. The question is why is that thing going on? Let's produce a correlation that's maybe a bit more convincing for you. Exactly the same thing, measuring inequality at the bottom. In this case, it's a measure of how much the top 1% take. And it's actually how much they took in 1983, a long time ago. So back in 1983, the best off 1% in Singapore were taking about 10% of all income. Statistics of doing the 1% are very easy. The 1% are 1 in 100 people. The best off 1% are the 1 in 100 people who have the highest incomes. If they're taking 10% of all income, they're taking 10 times the average income a year. That leaves only 90% for everybody else. I can begin to demonstrate these things. I'll do it later. I think the most interesting way to demonstrate it is to think about children and pocket money. And imagine that you were a class of children and we had £100. And the lady at the back there, we're going to give you £10 a week. And we're going to share £90 amongst the rest of you. So you're going to get less than £1 each. And the question is, what would you think about her at the back if you were at school with her? That's the kind of society that they live in Singapore and other very unequal countries. So here you see the general relationship. The infant mortality measure is relatively recent. The inequality measure is from a generation ago. Inequality has risen in all these states, the United States, but the relationship is there. I won't read through the text. The text is about Texas. And in Texas, they've closed down maternity units. And more mothers now die giving birth. And more babies die, normally around the time of birth. I just want to concentrate on the exception, just for a minute. And the exception is Singapore. People often say when you show them these graphs, and imagine a graph of how many cigarettes you smoke and your chance of getting lung cancer. They often say correlation isn't causation, which of course it isn't. But it isn't also a coincidence that you get these correlations again and again. So what's Singapore doing? Singapore's a relatively unequal country. It has a racial divide between the Chinese and the Malay. People are treated differently according to their ethnic background. The rich are very rich and the poor are pretty poor. So how does Singapore manage to get one of the best infant mortality rates in the world? The clue is that Singapore doesn't boast about its infant mortality rate. And that gives you an idea that something is going on in Singapore. Singapore does have a very good hospital. Just one big hospital, because it's only a city really. And that hospital, if you get into that hospital and give birth, you're probably going to be okay. The reason I think, and I can't prove it, I'd love for somebody to study this, the reason why I think the infant mortality rate in Singapore is so low isn't because the hospital is so good. It's because Singapore, children are going to come in the right time, they're fine. Singapore has 100,000 maids, and the maids are servants. And if you have a maid, if you're paying for a maid, if she becomes pregnant, you are responsible for the cost of her giving birth, which is many, 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 many times more than you're paying her. So, what happens in Singapore is that the maids are pregnancy tested. They were pregnancy tested every 6 months. They're now pregnancy tested every 3 months. And if they're found to be pregnant, they're deported. So they don't have a child in Singapore. If you stop the poorest people in your society from having children, and children are lovely, if you stop the poorest people from having children, and it's the poorest people who always have the highest infant mortality rate, then your infant mortality rate can get down to 2. Now what actually happens is that the maids delay having children, or they go back to Malaysia or the Philippines and have a child, they leave the baby with their mother and come back, or they have an abortion. The reason I'm telling you the story of Singapore is that one of the fascinating things about these graphs is to look at the countries that are not on the line, and then you often find a story about an exception that's going on. Let me take you forward. And again, what we've done here is we've taken, this is the 20 richest countries in the world, and all the states of the United States. And if you were to do this separately, you wouldn't get a relationship. If you just looked at the rich countries, you would say, it looks random. And if you just looked at the states of the United States, you might say, there's nothing going on there. If you just look at the black dots, there's no pattern. If you just look at the grey dots, there's no pattern. If you put the dots together, you begin to get what looks like a pattern. But not as strong as infant mortality. Infant mortality is related to the circumstances before birth, in the 9 months before birth, and afterwards, with some evidence of some relationship going back long in time. Life expectancy, what happens to you over the whole course of your life, affects the chances if you die at 70, 75, 80, 85. For any individual, it's chance. For any of you, I can ask you 15 questions, and then I can give you an average age at which you're probably going to die. We did it for a television game show. But the important thing is that it's plus or minus 20 years. But for a group, we can get very, very accurate predictions. And because it's things that occur over the whole of somebody's life, if you live in a country which was a pretty good country, a country getting better, becoming more socially progressive, looking after the poor, where the gap between rich and poor was getting worse, getting better, and you were introducing universal health services, when you were young, as a child or a young adult, that has a benefit to your overall life expectancy. And if the country is becoming worse when you're older, it reduces it. So for life expectancy, you really want to measure inequality over the whole lifetime of people to get a fairly good idea of what's going on. I put Texas and Singapore out there again so you can have a look. And this little graph here. This little graph here is for the Netherlands and Switzerland, the top one, top right hand. Because before I go any further, one thing that is really important to understand is that inequality isn't rising everywhere. In fact, in most countries of the world at the moment, income inequality is now falling. In the majority of OECD countries, inequality is falling, income inequality is falling. we tend to be told it's rising everywhere, it's inevitable, it's globalization, we have to get used to it, it's how the market works, it rewards people with talent at the top. This is all rubbish. It is quite possible to get inequality low and fall. The fastest way to get economic inequality down is to lose a war. That's the quickest way. It's not a very enjoyable way to get inequality down. When you lose a war, the first thing that happens is the invading force gets rid of your elite. They are no longer allowed to own the country, just in case they come back and want to fight again. The most extreme example is Japan, where the Americans, when they invaded Japan, destroyed the aristocracy, destroyed the class system of Japan, took the land, and allocated the land as equally as possible to people to create the world's most equal society. Now you might be wondering, why did the United States create the most equal society in the world in 1946, 47, 48? It wasn't because they believed in inequality. The United States did this because they were really scared that the Japanese would have a revolution. So to stop the Japanese having a revolution, and because they felt a bit guilty over what they'd done, dropping 2 atomic bombs, and the enormous abortion rate in Japan after the war, they handed out land and wealth in Japan to give everybody an equal chance. It's the most dramatic social experiment, I think, in world history. Japan went from having one of the lowest life expectancies in the rich world in the 1930s and being one of the most unequal countries to today having the highest life expectancy and being one of the most equal countries. But you can't arrange to lose a war. When Germany lost the war, income inequality fell dramatically and stayed relatively low. Finland. People often forget that Finland was on the losing side in the Second World War, and this may have helped Finland, because in general, every single example I've ever seen, it is always better to replace your current elite and the people who are currently in power with new people. New people always do better as countries become more equal. Those two lines there are for Switzerland and the Netherlands, and it's showing the take of the 1%. From around about 1900, 1910, 100 years ago, to today. And the Netherlands have got down to about 6%. So the best of 1% only taking 6 times average incomes. And they've done that without a war, essentially. The Netherlands is not Scandinavian. Switzerland is less dramatic, but they've managed to keep the take of the top 1%. To just 10% of all income. And that's a major achievement for a country based on banking and cuckoo clocks, to keep the top 1%, not taking more and more and more, is hard work. And the Swiss managed it. The 1% in the UK take twice as much as the 1% in Switzerland. There are huge geographical variations between countries, and the huge geographical variations show you what's possible. When people say it's not possible, you can't do this, inequality is high everywhere, you have to learn how to live a bit, be nice to the poor, but you can't stop them being poor, they're just ignorant of the geography. So say again, most countries now have got falling income inequalities, if not falling wealth inequalities. The exceptions are the United States, the UK, Brazil, probably Turkey. These are the exceptions. In between, it's different. I'm now going to show you a few graphs about Britain, because I know about Britain. I apologise for not being in Britain, so I'll go through them fairly quickly. But I thought some of this might interest you. These maps are called cartograms. They stretch the country so that people get an equal amount of space. So London is big at the bottom. Scotland is roughly the same type of size as Greater London. The map at the bottom is the EU referendum map. It's the map of who voted in and who voted out. It's a remarkable map because it doesn't look like any other map of human geography in the UK. The one nearest me shows the percent of the vote. And essentially London voted in very, very heavily. You could only vote if you're British, So the London School of people who don't have a right to vote, all the people who had the right to vote, almost all of them voted to remain. This dot, you have to guess, but halfway to Wales, that's Oxford where I come from. The little dot above London is Cambridge. You begin to see a pattern. Remain was strongest in elite areas, in areas where people were doing well, in areas where if you're not doing well, because of the house prices, you have to leave. The Leave voted to blue areas, and actually, although it's hard to see on the map, a majority of people who voted Leave in Britain live in the south of England, and the majority are also middle class. So if you're interested in Brexit, I can talk to you about Brexit till you get bored, sick. Why am I talking about Brexit in a talk about health? Because of these graphs above. In 2010, the then Prime Minister of the UK, David Cameron, announced that we were going to measure happiness. He said he wanted to make people happier, and his government were going to make them happier, and we would create an index of happiness, and we would get happier every year. And so they created an index of happiness, and it was quite a complicated index. Nobody reported on what happened to that index. What I'm showing you here are two of the most important components from the index of happiness. This is the official government index of how happy people are in Britain, made by David Cameron. And these are the measures of how many people were satisfied with their health, how many people were somewhat satisfied. 2009, 10, 10, 11, 11, 12, 12, 13, and 14 is down as well. Every year from 2010, a higher proportion of people were saying that their health was bad. The decline in their reported health was so fast that when you showed these graphs to people who study health, they just said, oh, that has to be rubbish. That can't happen, that never happens. What they said is it's an artifact. It can't be true. The interesting thing is it turns out it probably was true. And it may well have affected the vote. Because if you've got people who are feeling more and more ill, feeling that things are falling apart, that they're not in control, you have to remember this is after the financial crash of 2008. If you have a country where more and more people are not happy with what's going on, and you offer them a referendum in 2016 where they have a choice between just two things, carrying on exactly as we are, or something completely different, people may well choose something completely different. This graph appeared in the Economist, so it's not just me who produces complicated graphs that nobody can understand. This is in the Economist magazine. The Economist magazine, after the election of Donald Trump, ran regression models on every single variable they had for all US counties, trying to predict what it was that had caused some people to vote for Trump in some areas and other people not. And The Economist magazine is not a particularly biased publication. And this is the strongest correlation they could find. Along the bottom, you've got an index of health in counties. What's happening to life expectancy, what's happening to mental health in the county, all put together in an index. And along the y-axis, you've got a change in the support for the Republicans. In other words, for Trump. And above the line are counties where more people voted for Trump in the presidential election than the vote of Republican in the last presidential election. And they were key. Trump wouldn't have won. He won with a minority of votes, but Trump wouldn't have won without getting a swing, without getting more people in some places voting for him. And the areas where people voted for him more are away from me than the areas in which their health in those counties was dropping fastest, where the opiate crisis was worse, where young people's suicide rate was highest, where the elderly weren't doing well. Now, the voters were not poor themselves. Trump voters were mainly middle-class men, but they were middle-class men in areas which were falling apart and going downhill. So both in the UK and the USA, you can make connections between politics and health that go both ways. It's not just that your politics and the party in power alters how well your country is organised, and that affects your health. The health of people also affects how they behave and what they're willing to vote for. And if health becomes worse, if people begin to worry about it more, they're much more willing to vote for extreme anything but this options. And these are things that we're only just beginning to discover. Let me show you a couple of free graphs about the crisis in Britain. We first of all noticed the crisis in 2012. In 2012, women over the age of 85 began to die 5.5 weeks before they were dying the year before. 5.5 week loss in life expectancy. It was shocking because it hadn't happened for years. And some of us said the reason why more elderly women are dying is because they're more likely to be living on their own, and we just halved the number of social workers who might go and visit them. We got rid of the Meals on Wheels service, so if you're bedridden, you would no longer get a meal brought to you. We cut pension benefits, buses in rural areas have been cut, all in the aftermath of the financial crash. And whereas a man is much more likely to be married than be with a woman, because men tend to marry women who are younger than them, and men tend to die 5 years earlier, so men have a great advantage of not dying on their own, women are much more likely to be on their own. And you don't want to be living on your own when things fall apart in terms of the state. That was 2012. The government said it was influenza. It was a really bad flu epidemic. It got worse in 2013. And the government said it was influenza, really bad, new strain of flu. It didn't get much worse in 2014, it was just still bad. And then in 2015 we got this. This is the absolute rise in mortality by age group. And you can see it's the most elderly, the most frail, whose chances of dying rose the most. And partly because it was the most elderly, the reaction was, well, you know, they're old anyway. So what if old people are dying a bit earlier? You know, times are tough. But that wasn't the public reaction. The public reaction was, it's a really bad case of influenza epidemic again. Now, as you can tell, I'm beginning to get sick of the influenza. The problem with the influenza argument was, influenza tends to strike over about 10 weeks. There tends to be a peak of it. It doesn't just affect the elderly. In fact, it's least likely to affect some of the elderly because they will have had the influenza strain before. But also it tends to affect neighbouring countries because influenza doesn't know what national boundaries mean. And you tend to be able to find out the virus and test it and find it actually is influenza. And none of these things happen because it was not influenza. But flu, influenza is a convenient thing for government to say. And they said it again in 2015. If you've got very good eyesight, the years down the side are the years of the worst rises in deaths in the country I live in since we began to record this. The worst year was 1918, the end of the First World War, and the year of the pandemic in real influenza, the influenza flu internationally. Then cholera in 1848, then a very cold winter in 1895. You can go down. And there, at number 20 is the actual flu in 1951, actual flu in 1968, 2015, by that measure. I can do other measures that show it's worse. But that was 2015. There was a reason why that didn't make headlines. The Office for National Statistics in the UK released the data as scheduled on the day they always release it, which is the 23rd of June. The 23rd of June 2016, when the data came out, also happened to be the day when the Brexit referendum result was released. And understandably, the fact that we may be leaving the EU completely covered the news, and nobody noticed that mortality rates were rising in the country. But then they got worse in 2016, 2017, and much worse in 2018. This is the relative graph. What you saw below before was absolute rises. This is the percentage change. For very young people, because so few die, it's not that meaningful. The interesting thing here is the 25 to 29 year olds. The only age group of adults where mortality didn't rise in the UK were aged 25 to 29. When those annual statistics came out about population, they showed something else. That 25 to 29 year olds are the age group of highest in-migration to Britain. Britain has benefited from an incredible influx of really well-educated, really, really healthy migrants, particularly of that age. So healthy that you can put them into a country with a declining health service and they don't die. We're trying to work out what the life expectancy of Britain would be if you exclude all these people, 3 million people, who we didn't pay to educate them. Some other country pays for them to go to school and university. They come into Britain, they do really low-paid jobs, they live in the cheapest housing at the most overcrowded rates, and they don't die and they don't use our health service. Anyway, let's go forward. These graphs were produced by Professor Martin McKee in an airplane over Mongolia last week. So this is how fast the story is changing. Martin McKee is the president of the European Public Health Association. And so this is the very latest data. The top graph are infant mortality rates in the UK. And you can see that they are rising. You may not think that is dramatic. The last time in the UK infant mortality rose 2 years in a row was at the end of the Second World War, during the war. Infant mortality always falls. The places where it should stop falling first are places like Finland and Japan, where it's already got so low, how can you make it go lower? The final infant mortality rate is now rising. As far as I know, it isn't rising anywhere else in Europe. It isn't rising here, it's not rising anywhere. And it's not an uproar, people don't complain about it. One quick anecdote. Thursday night, about 3 weeks ago, the BBC News reported that of the 6 maternity units in my county of Oxfordshire, in England, 5 had immediately closed their doors and you couldn't give birth in them. And if you had a home birth scheduled, you were going to give birth at home, the midwife was going to come to you, it was cancelled. And all the midwives were brought into the central hospital from the whole county, and everybody had to go there to give birth because we didn't have enough midwives. 1 in 3 of our midwives is an EU but not a UK citizen. People are going back. People have began going back around the time before the vote because the atmosphere was so hostile. One of those maternity units is in a town called Chipping Norton. Chipping Norton is one of the most affluent towns in the UK, which is the 6th most affluent country in the world. Chipping Norton is where the former Prime Minister lives. And if you were pregnant in Chipping Norton, you were told you had to check the Facebook page of the maternity unit when you went into labour to see if it was open. And if it wasn't open, you needed to drive to the hospital. And the only problem is that in the morning in Oxfordshire, at about 6:30 or 7 o'clock, the roads are rather like the roads here. And your chances of actually getting to the hospital before you give birth are pretty low. In a very rich country, in one of the richest parts of a very rich country. If you're trying to work out why is that thing suddenly stopped getting better. But people don't get angry. Not that angry. It's interesting what it takes. What it would take would be the story of a single event. It would be the story of somebody trying to give birth on the side of the road. That would make them angry. Showing people the graph doing that doesn't make it angry. The bottom two graphs are the life expectancy changes in England. And again, you can see the change is slow. The difference, if you're very nervy about this, is the changing slope. The bottom two graphs, when life expectancy stops getting better, was around about 2010 to 2011, and it was when a new government came in that didn't care very much and cut things. The infant mortality graph changes around about 2016, 2015. It's when the Brexit referendum married to the country somewhere you wouldn't necessarily want to live if you didn't come to mainland. And so we began to be unable to hire health staff in the numbers we had before. The deaths amongst the babies are concentrated on the first day of life. These are babies dying around the time of birth, so it's about healthcare. Some international comparisons warning. This was produced by the Office of National Statistics in August of this year. It's a comparison. Again, it's the most affluent countries in the world. So again, we are comparing countries that have choices over what they want to do. The blue bars are the change in life expectancy, in this case for women, in the most recent 6 years. Now, in the most recent 2 years, in the US and UK, it's actually dropped. But in the most recent 6 years, it was rising by a fraction, of a week. So hardly rising at all. And all those other countries are doing better. There's Japan at the top, there's Denmark, there's Finland. And you would have thought that people in the UK and USA would have said, this is terrible. But they don't, because in an unequal country like the UK or the USA, social attitudes change. And they change to say, well, you should look after yourself. If you don't smoke, if you exercise, if you eat well, you'll be okay. Life expectancy has nothing to do with government. In countries which are more socially cohesive, people still say that, but they also say government has a role to play making sure that, for instance, you can walk or cycle to work, which is better for your health. You may be wondering about the yellow bars. The yellow bars are what happened 6 years earlier, and then the UK and USA did pretty well. I haven't looked into the USA, but the really interesting thing about the UK is those preceding 6 years, this is 2004 to 2010, those were the years when the UK received that really, really big migration from Eastern Europe, because we opened up and Germany didn't. And so we got all the really clever people from Poland who came first, and our life expectancy shot up. And that's what happens if you have an influx of people who are very healthy, I think, into a country. The same with them, just showing you briefly. Again, the USA and the UK have done particularly badly in the last 6 years. And again, although it's not shown on the graph, they're actually going down. Now, the UK life expectancy peaked in 2014. Lower in 2015-16 than we now know, 17. Again, as of last week, it's been lower. Apart from the 1990 flu pandemic, there isn't a time this has happened before. This has happened without the pandemic. This is all about social, political, and economic influences. It shows what happens when you allow it to happen. Just going to show you two more comparisons, but one map, first of all. This is the only European map I've got, so enjoy it. Again, these maps stretch space, so that you only look at places where people live, because normal maps divert your eye away and you end up looking at the wrong area. So if you start off in the UK, next to the UK is Ireland. Ireland is coloured various shades of blue. The dark blue are areas where 20% or more of the population was born in another country. Quite a lot of people in Ireland are born in Northern Ireland and moved to the Republic, were born in the Republic and moved to the North. Ireland also has quite a lot of migration, particularly from Poland, because it's Catholic. So it's a high migration area. In the UK, you can see that part of London is dark blue. The rest of the UK has pretty low migration. So although we've got lots of migrants, the migrants come to areas where there's lots of work. Going down, you can see that big circle beneath London is Paris. And all cities tend to attract migrants. If you go down to Spain, you can see Madrid. But you can also see the Mediterranean coast of Spain, which has a high proportion of migrants. One of the largest groups of migrants on the coast of Spain are English. English people retire to Spain if they can, because it's warm and sunny. And we're waiting to welcome them back. Because come the 29th of March, they're no longer going to get healthcare in Spain. So if they fall ill, they have to come back to Britain. That's going to be fun. But here we are. There's this number. You see this to me? If you want a kind of comparison of how big it is, it's big. I'm talking it's bigger than the average country in Europe, but it's kind of like not impossibly big, I'd say, on that map. I'm very used to these maps. I've looked at these for 20 years, so this is the kind of way I look at geography. What's the reason for showing you that? It wasn't the migrants. They were not the reason why things were bad in most of Britain, because there weren't any migrants. Most of Britain is the same shade of colour, a very pale yellow, as Eastern Europe. Less than 1 in 20 people are a migrant in most of Britain. The second highest correlation with the Leave vote was migration. The more migrants an area had, the less likely people were to vote to leave. People said the reason they voted to leave was migrants above all else, but it was people who'd been made scared of migrants by newspapers in areas where there were not migrants who voted most to leave. The highest correlation with the Leave vote was being fat. Having a waistline like mine was slightly higher. And you may be wondering, why do people who are fat vote Leave more often? And it's not because they're fat. It's almost certainly a very complicated relationship which has to do with migrants. Because migrants aren't just young, fit, well educated and energetic. They're also, on average, annoyingly thin. And if you have lots of thin people who turn up in, say, London, and you're my kind of size, you think, oh, I better start losing some weight. Whereas if you live in a part of the country where migrants don't turn up, you can all quietly get fatter together. Now, I won't take that any further, but it is the highest correlation for Leave vote, is waistline. And it's not because fat people are lazy. I've been putting on weight just so I can make this point. Maybe the most important graph about differences between countries. This is showing basically how much people are taxed in each country and how much is spent on public services. And there are huge differences. The data comes from the IMF. And there are enormous differences in the choices you can make. I have to mention Ireland because Ireland does the most amazing thing here. Ireland was a low tax, low spending country, about 33%. Ireland, in the financial crisis, followed the advice of the British. We told them to bail out every single bank account, which was really bad advice. And they ended up spending over 2/3 of their GDP, largely bailing out the Irish banks. Ireland's now down there. But Ireland's just one strange country that has sold its soul to Amazon and Google now. And the reason why Amazon and Google have headquarters in Ireland is that Ireland is semi-bankrupt. The United Kingdom, less than 40% of GDP spent on public services, relatively low tax rates. It rises a little bit in 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. That rise is actually spending money on a war in Iraq. That increases. It then jumps up like all countries do when they have to spend to stop the banks falling apart. And it's now set to get down to 36% of GDP. So only just over a third being spent on public services. If you take out our aircraft carrier and our nuclear weapons, the rest of the armed forces, that goes a lot lower. On the other hand, you can look at France or Finland or Denmark, where they spend roughly half of what they earn on public services. So the universities are free, they have more doctors per head, they have more hospital beds, people live longer, the quality of housing is better, and go on and on. It's not all perfect, but there's just this huge variation. And then within each country, the political debate is really constrained. So within the UK, we currently have the widest difference we've had between political parties for years, between the party of government and the main opposition. But all the Labour Party wants to do It's moved from 36 up to 38. That's the most radical thing that we've been offered in my lifetime. That 36 goes to 38. People say it's completely unaffordable. And that's why I think this graph matters. And it shows you what you can do. You can only move a bit within where you are in a few years. In a generation or two generations, you can move completely. But barring a war or a disaster, you can't move these things that fast. I'm going to overrun, so I'm going to skip through graphs quickly and get to the point. These are the kind of public health messages we put out now. We have enormous problems with debt. We have enormous mental health problems. We have people who are anxious and depressed. So we try to tell them not to feel so bad about what's happening. The average debt levels in the country are directly related to inequality. The more inequality there is in the country, the more people get into debt. Partly because they have to, because it's the only way to buy a house or to basically get through life with credit cards. But also people consume more in more unequal countries. They feel the need to consume more. So poor people buy more things in the United States than poor people buy in the UK. And poor people in the UK buy more things than people who are poor in Germany, because they're told that buying is good. In the US, they spend 4% of their GDP on advertising. Advertising is purely to try to get you to buy something you don't need. 4% of GDP. In the UK, it's 2%. In the rest of Europe, it's 1%. I'm going to very quickly show you a series of weird graphs. These graphs are about, first of all, political support and then life expectancy, but I'll go through them quickly because I want to know your questions. Along the y-axis, you've got how popular a party is, and along the x-axis, you've got the change in time of support. I don't expect you to understand these graphs because hardly anybody has ever seen these graphs before. So if you can understand this graph, it's called the face-based diagram. You are a nerd and you are weird. Congratulate yourself and come and tell me later. If any of you have seen a graph like this, please tell me. But essentially, the height is how popular the party is, and the x-axis is how it's changing. This is support in the United Kingdom for the far, far right. Parties on the far, far right. UKIP, National Front, fascists. It used to be very low, and then you'll see it bouncing up. It bounced up in 2004, 2009, 2014, and now again. The reason for showing it you is it makes me optimistic. Because it shows that in a country like Britain, the far, far right don't have a growing level of support. Whatever is happening is going on to get people to vote that way just before European elections, and then they forget their far, far right afterwards. So you have to just believe me on that. UK is a very strange country. In 2014, in the European election then, 51.9% of people, 51.9% of people in 2014 in the UK voted for the political party, which is to the right of normal European Conservatives. In other words, the majority of the electors who voted far right in my country. We don't just call it far right, we call it Conservative. But we are living through the repercussions of this at the moment, which is why we have an obsession about the far, far right. Here's another of those graphs, and the reason for showing you is the other side of politics in the UK. I'm only showing you because that great big curve has never happened before in British political history. That is the rise in support for the Labour Party in May and June of last year. The biggest, fastest, most dramatic rise of support for any political party ever in the history of the UK, leading to a swing in support as actually bigger than 1945. So we've got loads of things going on in the politics of the country at the same time. We've got no idea what's going to happen. No idea what's going to happen between now and the 29th of March. And we've got an electorate who are willing to behave in ways they've never behaved before, which makes everything unpredictable. Both to a good side from my point of view. I like this. I support the party that got this. And to a dangerous side, in that it's entirely possible for people with money and in control newspaper headlines to get other people to vote for extreme people who are fascists. Let's go through these quickly. These are life expectancy graphs, just to show you the variation across Europe. They're a year out of date. We now know the UK is the worst across Europe. Life expectancy then up to 81. When it moves across, it means it's actually dropping. And this is comparing the UK and Finland. Two countries, very near each other. Whatever it was not influenza, because influenza would also hit Finland. And whatever Finland are doing, they're doing the right thing, because the life expectancy is still steadily rising. That's a really obvious case. Germany and Norway, not so obvious. Norway's doing something right. What's going on in Germany? My suspicion about Germany, because the latest data for Germany is much better, my suspicion is that in general, migrants are good news. Now 1.4 million people who've just escaped from a war are not necessarily the healthiest, happiest people. And I suspect if you move a million people into a country who are war refugees, you should expect a slight reduction in overall life expectancy, particularly if some of them are injured. I'll just put it like that. Spain and Sweden. But again, differences. And Sweden hasn't taken well. Hasn't taken many migrants from Syria, but has taken a lot of migrants from Libya and other places in that year. And again, Spain's done better in more recent years. France and Denmark, it's not all conclusive. Italy and the Netherlands, 2015 was a weird year. Switzerland and Ireland. So we're not quite sure what's going on, and the data has to be updated. That's the graphs for inequality over time in the UK. The basic story is that 100 years ago, the richest 1% had a fifth of all income. They had servants. Everybody else was much poorer. This was normal in most of the world. And then inequalities fell and fell, all the way down to the 1970s, by when the richest 1%, when I was a child, had only 6% of all income, or just 4% after tax. I grew up at the most equal time my country has ever been. The large European countries, only Sweden was more equal than the country I grew up in. And then UK chose to do that, and became more and more and more unequal. And it's a choice. Because the wonderful thing for academic research is that different countries in Europe have different things. And so we can begin to try to measure the effect. Here's the league table. This is how much more money the best off 10th have compared to the worst. So in Japan, if you're in a family, the best off 10th, you're on average about 4.5 times more than the worst off 10th. That's as good as it gets at the moment. As far as we know, nothing goes wrong in Japan. Because one interesting question is, how equal can you be? And is there a problem with becoming more equal? Communist countries, by the way, never managed that great level of equality. China is similar to the USA in terms of inequality. People often think communism means equality. It doesn't, in practice. Japan, then Finland, Norway, Sweden, they all line up wonderfully in stats. Germany, Austria, Slovenia, South Korea, Denmark, Belgium, Switzerland. So this is the kind of international league table of inequality for most affluent countries. Going up and up and up, France, Netherlands, Ireland, Canada, Greece, Spain, Italy, New Zealand, Australia, then Israel. Israel's a very divided country. This is Israel, including the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Right? But even more unequal than Israel is the United Kingdom. Now, we don't think of ourselves as more unequal than Israel, but we are. And then just above us, it's changed now. Portugal was more unequal than the US and then Singapore. If you're wondering, this is my one graph from Turkey because I was feeling guilty about it. And you probably know this. This is wealth and income inequality. Came out September this year. It looks like to me like the best estimates. I haven't said much about wealth inequality, so I won't, but essentially the income inequality level for Turkey puts it just above Russia. So more unequal than Russia, more unequal than the US, below Brazil. Very, very unequal. And why is it? And that's unusual. I haven't got time, and you'll be glad to know I haven't put it in the slides, but I can show you that in the majority of OECD countries, income inequality peaked in 2013 and has been falling since. And if it didn't peak in 2013, it peaked in 2014. And it's been falling since. It's only just the start of it falling. But you don't get a situation which the richest, greediest people in the world who meet in Davos say that the worst problem the world faces is inequality and something is done about it. Where the Pope says the worst problem is inequality, where Barack Obama says the worst problem is inequality, where the President of China, when he's asked what is the biggest problem in the world, said inequality. If you get enough people saying inequality is a big problem, you will tend to get to peak inequality. The question is whether you can get it to go down. But that's just a very nerdy slide updating the figures. If you're wondering why Turkey isn't in there, it's because Turkey doesn't get into the top 25. The countries who are beating Turkey in GDP per capita are Kuwait, UAE, Hong Kong, and Qatar jumped in. Somebody really ought to do this study for the best of 50 countries in the world, rather than the best of 25. Just some more general things. We're in the last 5 minutes now. Please do think of a question. Could be even faster than 5 minutes. There are many wider aspects of what goes wrong when you become more unequal that we didn't know about. This one, I'm pretty sure, is registered intellectual patents per head. So it's how many inventions are being recorded in each country and each US state. People often say, oh, you know, inequality is bad because it means you're rewarding entrepreneurs, and because the wealthy get to keep their wealth and create more wealth for us and others, it's good. And business is good, and the US is great at inventing things. The only problem is the numbers show that isn't true. Switzerland is an exception here because of the pharmaceutical industry, and because they love patenting every single drug. This is carbon footprint. This may be one of the most interesting ones. People, everybody in a more equal country, even with the same level of GDP per head, everybody buys less. They don't feel the need. They buy clothes that last longer. They have less in their wardrobes. They feel less need to go on holidays and require flying somewhere. They buy fewer cars. They arrange public transport systems. Think Japan, think Germany. You know, which have trains and trams. In the Netherlands, half the population walk and cycle to work. The carbon footprint is generally lower in more equal countries, but also lower in more equal states. And again, you can look at the exceptions. You'll see Australia is an exception. Australia could try and develop a really good railway system, but it's still a very big country. You get bored, so you want to fly. And if you want to leave Australia, you have to fly. As I said at the beginning, the exceptions are really interesting. Conclusions. And then two more bubble graphs. Then we end. We're in the middle of discovering this. How much money you get really matters. Really matters. Who's a student here? Put your hand up. Okay, hand up higher. Don't worry, I'm not going to embarrass you. This is England. People can put their hands up if I mention income. Now, if you were to discover that this university was paying some of you, I don't know, the equivalent of 5,000 euros a year, just giving it to you because they liked your hair colour, so, you know, the other students might get extremely annoyed about that. You begin to feel the annoyance. We managed to create an artificial divide, so you're not that worried about how much the staff are paid, because you've got to know they're paid. But the staff, if you discovered each other's salary and found that somebody was being paid much more than you, you just get upset. It's about respect. Money isn't just about what you need to get by, it's about how much people respect you. And it alters levels of trust. There were lovely trust questions. You ask people, would you ask a stranger to look after your bags on the train when you go to the toilet? And you'll find that the majority of people in Norway say yes. The majority of people in the UK will say no. The good news is you can always trust a stranger to look after your bags on the train. You'd be so unlucky if they stole them. But in countries where we are paid differently, where we don't tell each other how much we're paid, we don't trust each other in other ways. If you were students in England, and you were undergraduate students, you'd be paying £9,000 a year to be at university. But if you're my university, perhaps 1 in 30 you wouldn't be paying that. You'd be paying nothing, because your mum and dad would pay that. 2/3 have to pay 9,000, 1/3 doesn't. The ones who have to pay 9,000, they have to pay 27,000 over 3 years, with interest that can rise to £60,000. So you get a sense of how unfair people think it is, that some have to have a large debt because their parents weren't rich. But if your parents are rich, you pay the least for nothing to go to university. We don't understand each other in unequal countries. People begin to get fearful of the poor. They say that they're poor and lazy and feckless. They say that the rich are very clever and deserve their income because they're so good. We learn worse. The outcomes of our universities and schools are worse in unequal countries. I'm going to show that in a minute. If you have exam results, we begin to say exam results are really important rather than just education. And I'm going to show you this in maths. So here's the first of the last bubble plots. Again, that measure of income inequality is on the bottom, and on the y-axis you've got maths ability. And this is done at age 15, international maths test by PISA, age 15. And you can see a kind of relationship there. But it's not really, really strong, but it's there. The US are not very good at maths. They say they're good at maths. I will be teaching next week US master's students. I will ask them how many of you have done calculus. They put their hands down, their calculus have got a GPA at 4.0. Then I'll say, can you explain to me what calculus is? And none of them will. They won't. I mean, it's stunning. But you're kind of taught self-confidence in the USA. Whereas in Switzerland and Japan, South Korea, they do much better at maths. In Singapore, they hot house them. So in Singapore, they do really well at maths, but actually the children are slightly disturbed by what's happened to them. But that's not the graph I want you to look at. I want you to look at this graph. It's almost exactly the same maths test. The big difference is that it's now being done at age 24. And this is fascinating. Now, I don't know when you did. Who did their last mathematics exam when they were 15 or 16 here? Nobody's going to admit to it, I won't try. In England, I ask people to put up who got an A star, who got an A, who got a B. And then this graph shows you why it doesn't matter. In countries like the United States and the United Kingdom, whatever we're doing over how we teach maths, we're teaching maths in such a way that by the age of 24 you've forgotten it, and you do really badly on the test. And whatever they're doing in the more equal countries, they're teaching mathematics in a way where people can still do maths a bit later in life. And part of the point of education is not to get a high score one day in an exam and then forget it forever. It's to learn things. And I can sort of say this in this condescending way because I come from one of the unequal countries where we don't learn things and where we think exam results are really important. But this kind of shows things going on. Not to do with health at all, something very different. But if you have a population who are being made innumerate because of the way they're taught, then if you tell them that the top 1% are getting more and more, a large proportion of that 1%, a large proportion of the population won't understand what 1% means. Or they'll say, I want my child to be in the top 1%. And if you try to explain to people that not everybody can be in the top 1%, because only 1% of people can ever be in the top 1%, in a country where people can't do percentages, but they've still got an A or a B on their math score because they could do percentages in one day, it becomes very, very different. It's a difference, this is a kind of graphical description. You can have a very unequal country. It's the curve ladder here. What's really interesting about an unequal country, things are very bad at the bottom, but at the top they're also pretty bad too. And in particular, people at the top are really scared of falling down. And so one reason why we have this concentration in the exam results in my country is that the majority of parents in the top 10% pay for their children to be tutored and tutored and tutored to get the highest results so their children won't have to take an average job. And they're always afraid that their children might have to take an average job. Now the only way that other children can go up is if some children go down. So kind of country you want is a happy little adder. If you want to get social mobility, you have to make sure that dropping down isn't that bad. So you can, for instance, be a nurse, a care physician, or a teacher, and not think being a teacher means never being able to afford to buy a house, not being able to rent somewhere that's nice, at a rent that's decent. That's enough from me. Thank you ever so much for your attention. I'm really interested in what you've got to ask, and I promise to keep my answers short. Thank you.
He'll take up two questions in a row. Two, actually, respectively. Any questions?
Thank you, that was very, very informative. I actually have two questions, if that's okay. The first one, as you mentioned, I'm Aysel, by the way, I come from the Real Bomber Institute. So the first question is, as you rightly mentioned, there's an importance and altering are interconnected, and it's not only the government policies which impact self, but also how people self also affect how they vote. As you mentioned, but what I don't understand is in two examples that you gave, about Brexit and Trump, why people vote for authorities, let's say, who are more likely to implement policies that are going to impact their health in an even more negative manner. Is that only because there are middle class people who think that their taxes are going to be spent on poorer people or what? So if you could elaborate on that, that would be great. And the second question is sort of a grand one. What do we do about this? The whole presentation is basically about how social inequalities impact or affect or cause health inequalities. But in this day and age where people are more likely to vote for extreme right policies, which tend to implement less and less authoritarian policies, how do we, or what can we do to sort of get rid of social inequalities? Because, that's the ultimate thing that is going to make the,
problematic. Yeah. On your first question, there's no way of proving it just a sample of two, but it's a remarkable coincidence that the two rich countries with falling life expectancies would do this. And then the third country which was supposed to go after the UK and the US was France. France was supposed, if you remember, to vote for Le Pen. It was really seriously possible that the majority of people in France would vote for Le Pen. And then the French got together, and two-thirds of them voted for somebody that none of them liked, and he's now the president, just to stop Le Pen. And I would say that's what they do in a more equal country where you know each other. Why did they do it? I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that people don't know what's going on. So the big rise in the deaths in Britain, that 50,000 rise, it's largely middle-class people. If you remember, it's women over 85. This is very elderly people. The majority of people who get to live to 85 in Britain, middle-class, the working class die in their late 60s and 70s. But the middle-class in Britain don't realise that they rely on the National Health Service more than the working class because they live longer and they stay alive longer. So a huge lack of realisation of what's going on. They think the health service is being used by feckless poor people. They don't realise that it's them. John Hills at the LSE had a brilliant study which shows us on average people in the United Kingdom who pay more tax actually use public services just as much as the tax they pay, primarily because they live so much longer, 10 years on average longer. And those extra years, if you smoke cigarettes, which in Britain means much more likely people working class, a lung cancer death is painful but a relatively short death. If you don't smoke cigarettes and you live all the way through to your 70s and 80s and you have repeated problems, you go to the hospital again and again and again. But this isn't widely understood, both in the US and the UK. In the US, socialised healthcare is seen as evil. in the United States, diplomat's my answer to be short, that's right. The way you teach a class in the United States about health inequality, the most effective way, is you don't do what I've just done. That doesn't work, they call you a communist and they don't come back the next day. What you do instead of a set of master's students in the US is you set them an essay question. The essay question is, why does the USA have the highest life expectancy in the world, and why is it the best place to be born as a baby? And the students go away and research this and find they can't answer it. And you have to do it that way because it's such a shock. And this is university students in the most prestigious universities in the US do not know the truth about the US. I think, but when you do have falling life expectancy, people have a sense that something is going badly wrong. They're told in both countries that the reason that things are going badly wrong is the immigrants. In Britain, we're told that the schools would be better if it wasn't for the immigrant children. Our health service would be better, but it's all the immigrants using our health service, and all the immigrants are in all their houses. People believe it. And in a way, Brexit is what we need, maybe, to convince British people, because people are leaving, and when everything doesn't get better. But these are extreme countries in an extreme position. The majority of people in Europe live in countries which are not like this, in which things are getting better. What do we do about it? I think it's like climate change. I think we're in the process of still trying to convince people that it's a problem. Lots of people don't want to believe that inequality is a problem. Partly because the way we've taught economics in some countries is to say that inequality is okay. It actually rewards talent. It penalises people who are lazy. And you're asking people to completely change beliefs that you've taught a whole generation. And similarly with climate change. Yeah, climate change, you're ultimately asking people that your children need to pollute less than you've polluted. You need to work out how to get around without the car. You need to buy less stuff, particularly less plastic stuff, and you need to have fewer holidays. And particularly if you're the richest 10%, you're most responsible to do less. And it's taken a whole generation to get that message through. And I wouldn't be pessimistic about it, but I think saying that one of the fundamental assumptions of classic economics at the moment, that inequality is not a problem, is completely wrong. It's hard, particularly when we have a model in universities that says that children are very unequal, some are very bright, you must concentrate those very bright students in universities and they should go on and earn high salaries because they deserve to because they're very bright. If that's your underlying model of education, which it is in the University of Oxford where I teach, saying that inequality is a problem, we need less of it. And part of the way you sell your university is come to Oxford and you'll get a high salary later. It's a generational change in thinking. And the other thing which I think is new about this is it's not so much a left-right argument, a bit like climate change. It's just becoming obvious. And when it becomes obvious, then the politics change to the right wing wanting to have less inequality, but not quite so quickly as the left wing. That's what you want to get to. And they're both going to make the world more equal. And this is what the Conservative Party did in Britain in the 1950s and when they were in power in the 1970s. They increased equality just not as fast as the Labour Party did. The Conservative Party built more government state houses than Labour at one point. I think it's a sea change in understanding. And once that's embedded, and it's also not that hard to get. In my country, half of all young people now go to university. The majority of those university graduates are women. There is absolutely no way they can, but there's more than 10% of the population. So the majority of university graduates will not be in the top 10% because there are too many university graduates. I think university graduates have to accept that most of them are failures and it's down to them that they're going to be struggling. Or they're going to want a more equal world. Having sent half the population to university, it's hard to defend inequality. My generation, only 6% of us went to university. We could all be rich. But once you've told half the population that you're clever, telling them then that you've got to have a life where you're going to first struggle, so that a few people would have a lot. That becomes much harder. I'm generally optimistic, but there will always be one or two countries where things are going very badly wrong. And if you're in one of those countries at the time where it's going very badly wrong, it can easily feel like there is no way it's going to get better. The last time inequality peaked in the UK was 1930. The last time we had a peak and it came down. We may get a peak now. 1913, there was a war that was supposed to last a few weeks. That went on 4 years. We had to tax the rich to pay for the war. There was a revolution in Russia, and that scared the rich. There was lots that happened. This time in the UK, we just had Brexit, which is bad, but it's small compared to a war. But it can take offence to knock it. So the question is, once it starts to come down, you do need to say, it is fine for it to carry on coming down. The more that the gap between rich and poor narrows, the better everybody does, including the rich. And that's the most fascinating thing. Because if the rich only understood that their own children or grandchildren would live much happier lives in a more equal society, it'd be much easier to achieve this, because it's the very rich who are paying for the newspapers to say that this is bad.
Just observation, actually, now that you said you're optimistic, there's been the discussion between growth or distribution has been one that's been around for a long time, as to what's best for humanity, at least in the capitalist sense, as we've discussed for a long time. And there seems to have been, at least more recently, two observations one could make. One is that the climate one that you referred to has led to some kind of a discussion that maybe growth is not the proper discussion. So there's more, maybe even that Davos, I'm not sure, that there is some discussion about what do we mean by redistribution when we talk about that, what is a sort of just distribution. But at the same time, there's the other side that you've been talking about. This is not going to end in a question. Rumination about what you were trying to observe, I would believe, through inequality, because it covered a wide range. The second one you were saying, people don't know, look at the, you know, it's a mixed picture, but there's in general wide inequality since particularly with 2008 crash, but then it's not so bad in some countries. Yet, you know, in places without migrants, people are voting for Brexit. In people with, you know, places with high inequality, people are voting far right. But then there's a whole lot of discussion now that it is precisely the anger that's doing it. You might not call it inequality. You might call it something else. I mean, the whole anti-elitist thing actually is a popular version of what you're saying over here. Why? Whether Trump solves it, someone else solves it, is not the point. But I think it's not so lack of knowledge of, in an experiential sense. You might not understand the graph, but you do live it. You do not make it to the hospital. NHS is a sorry affair now, after years of living in a different way, etc., etc. And right now, the latest election, Brazil. What was the choice? So now that comes to the other question. What is the choice? What is the choice that's being offered if you're meaning through some political process? If you don't mean through some political process, how else are we to show a protest or an amelioration of the situation? The proportions you were giving of the GDP, I noticed, for example, Greece has declined substantially in terms of expenditure by the government. They had to do it, or else EU was going to kick them out. This is the one that, you know, the Brexit looks one way in England, but from the point of view of the Greek retired person at the age of 70, it looks something else. The same as post-Soviet period, too. So I ranged like you did, in a sense, but I was trying to give a more of a sense of how that feels experientially and what does one do experientially. I think protest is there, whether one likes it or not. Otherwise, in such a different milieus, the things that keep surprising social scientists do happen. The surprising thing is that the social scientists are surprised.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really sad thing about Brazil, is that for somebody like me, it didn't make me sad, because Brazil beats South Africa, it beats every other country that we've got inequality statistics for. If Brazil hadn't voted for him, my grass would be worse. It's the predictability of this. No country in the bottom half of the income distribution is doing any of these stupid things. All the stupid things are being done in the half of countries which are most unequal, and in the top half of those countries. Putin is the same. And that's kind of good news. If one of those more equal countries suddenly elected somebody like him, that would be scary. But at least we got an idea that this kind of thing. And I can show you graphs of income inequality in Germany rising in the 1930s and in Japan rising in the 1930s. So income inequality tends to rise before fascism sets in. On growth, I sit on two councils of economists, and they're both left-wing, of course. In one, it's a taboo not to be pro-growth. So I'm quietly, I can tell you I'm zero growth, but I keep quiet. But they want green growth. But it's interesting, even amongst these far-left economists, growth is sacred. And, Britain is one of the richest countries in the world, and if you have a target of 2% growth, it's impossible. The reason why I concentrate on very rich countries is that it's easy to... A country that is average in the world just needs to have more money. But it's better if you share it out well. But for these countries, children's happiness, the most stunning thing, over a third of all children in the United States have severe mental health problems, whereas the proportion of mental health problems, particularly of girls, drops in more equal countries. If you worry about your children being seriously ill throughout their 20s, if I had the energy and I could learn other languages, I should leave England and move to another country. But what we do about it, I mean, if it was easy, it would be done. But part of what we do is we explain to people that your problems are caused by inequality, not by all the other excuses that they come up with. So not by influenza, in the case of health. Not by the immigrants, in the case of the UK, being told that the problem is immigrants. It's first of all explaining the problem is inequality is such a tangential idea. The idea that the gap between us is what matters. People just say, if you had more money, you'd be okay. The problem is if somebody else has more money, you can't do the thing with the money. So it is explaining it. If this is true, and this is the naive thing about being a university scientist, but if this is true and that truth becomes more widely known, and that seeps into the common understanding, it becomes harder to say everything will be better if you simply vote for the strong man but ignore the gaps between you. And the answer is you need the politicians of political parties who seriously are willing to say that they will reduce the inequality gap. They will put rent caps on. They will make sure you can go to university for free. But say they are doing it because there's something fundamentally bad about inequality. And actually have that as your remit. The other one I would do is more research about the rich, and particularly the children of the very rich and what happens to them. Because I think if more very affluent people understood that the trite example of musicians, if you look in the US, the people who done very well in the 1970s in music, most of them are dead. Take Michael Jackson. If you look at Sweden, you can think of the example of Sweden. They decided to stay in Sweden and pay their taxes, and ABBA are still all alive, and their children and their children live normal lives. It's the pills that the children of the super rich are popping to try to get themselves through the day. It's also this sense of the absolute fear. So one way I've had it described to me in England, I've noticed one interesting, in my city there are many homeless people on the streets, and we try not to look at them. You don't look at them and you never think you'll be in that situation. The very rich, this is the top half of the top 1% in England, look at somebody like me in exactly the same way as I look at a homeless person, and try to imagine that they would never be in the situation. I have to go to work. My job is lovely, but they can't imagine a life where you would have to go to work, and they're frightened of it. And it's that fear between which we then decide that person isn't like you, and it'll never happen to you. It's trying to educate people about that. Because if we didn't have this group of very powerful, very rich people trying so hard to elect right-wing politicians who will allow them to carry on being rich, mainly because they want their grandchildren and great-grandchildren to be rich. If that group would suddenly realise this isn't going to help your great-grandchildren, I do think that would be beneficial. And simply reducing one billionaire's sponsorship for a right-wing party would be helpful.
Presentation. My question is regarding the drop in England's health life expectancy. And you mentioned that it's not due to influenza and any health causes, but rather economic, social, and political changes.
Yes.
Do you think there are any reasons behind this? Like you mentioned some local reasons.
Yes.
I think Brexit and cut on the government expenditures. But do you think there are any reasons behind this, any trends which would affect also other developed countries? And what is the position in the greater picture?
Okay, we've checked a few of things. So it's fortunate this decline in health occurred at the same time as we banned smoking in pubs. So there's been a dramatic drop in smoking. So we know it's not smoking. We also know that alcohol intake is going up. People are getting more obese, but the aged people are dying, or the elderly who are, they didn't get fat. That's to come. So we've ruled out lots of other things. And it correlates most closely with the cuts to services, but also with a sense of despair amongst the elderly. What we can't prove is the underlying reason. Why has the government chosen to cut these things? And the theory is that they're doing it deliberately because they really don't rely on the National Health Service. Because the National Health Service in England is an example of a socialist way of organising things. It says you can organise things without the profit motive and they can work very well. And if you believe in the profit motive, then the NHS is a terrible thing. You need to get rid of it. And you need to bring in a semi-privatised system of insurance. And the only way you can do that is by running the National Health Service down so badly that people are willing to accept something else. And Jeremy Hunt, I am pretty sure that is what he wanted to do. The latest health minister, I think, is just not very clever. So I don't think he's doing it, but I'm guessing. Each country is different. I mean, we wrote an article in The Guardian recently about Finland, because Finland actually has proposals to do some privatisation for its health service. What's really fascinating about countries is whenever you go to a country, I challenge you to do this, I can never get people to tell me what's good about their country anywhere, including the Scandinavian countries. So if I was doing this talk in a Scandinavian country, there'll be two babies in the room. But I'd also make the mistake of saying, congratulations, you've got the lowest rate of child poverty in the world. And people would say, how dare you? It's terrible because 1 in 10 of our children are poor, and that's bad. And it may be the lowest in the world, but it's still too high. And that's good, because that's partly how they get the lowest child poverty. but also that will only tell me about what's bad about their country. And in Japan, people will say, oh, inequality is rising, you know. And I go, isn't that much? It's tiny, we can only dream of having it. But apart from the United States, where people will always tell me what's wonderful about the United States, nowhere else will people actually say what is good. So in most of Nigeria, where they have state education systems that are far better than in my country, people will talk about the problems in their schools. Nobody talks about their schools and says, our schools are better than average in Europe because we do this. And all social sciences look at problems. They don't look at success. So in Austria, people don't say, come to Vienna and look at our amazing system of housing. It's one of the fairest systems of housing people in the world. In Austria, you know, they're worrying about migrants.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.